Thank you for tuning into the VF1 show with VF and Vincenzo, the podcast that discusses all things business, marketing, politics, and government within the world of Formula One. If that's your thing, then you found the right place. So without further ado, it's lights out and away we go.
Welcome back to the VF1 show. My name is Vincenzo Landino. Joining me today, as always, my host, co-host, VF. On the other side of, well, not really on the other side of the world, but in the middle of the country. How you doing today, V?
I'm good. It's Friday. And it's also my birthday tomorrow. So I'm having lots of revelations right now of like, holy crap, I'm getting older. But it's fine. Everything is fine. Life goes on. How are you?
Should we sing happy birthday?
We should not sing happy birthday. I literally one of those few girls who doesn't give a shit about my birthday. So
got it. So you're not celebrating month long. Understood.
Have I made a single mention on social media about
No.
So
that you have not. Doing good over here on this side of the country. We have a really easy slate today, an easy birthday slate for you to talk about, for us to celebrate. Sink our teeth into. We'll talk a little bit about Toto Wolff and his new billionaire status, the Qiddiya project in Saudi Arabia. Fascinating, fascinating project they've got going on there and the track they're building. And Stefano Domenicali and his plans for 25 or more races. Before we get into the show, I want to remind all the listeners, please go and give us a 5-star rating and review over on your favorite podcast player. Let's kick off the show with, and it's so interesting, Toto Wolff became a billionaire, according to Forbes. What do you make of this? I have a whole bunch of thoughts on this, so I'm going to give it to you first.
I'm into it. I respect it. I think his rise in F1, very unlikely. Very just, I think, the right place at the right time kind of got him to where he is right now. So he's worth roughly $1.5 billion USD. I think if you can become a billionaire in what, three decades, riding this motorsports wave, that's pretty exciting. And I think right now you look at the effect that Drive to Survive has had. Obviously, that has impacted his valuation, that has impacted Christian Horner's valuation, Gunther Steiner's. I mean, we talked about a couple episodes ago how Gunther Steiner, from a marketability perspective, is kind of untouchable right now. The only thing that he's being criticized for is his whole spat with Toto about Mick Schumacher. That's a conversation for another time. But you cannot deny right now that Drive to Survive has had a significant effect on the worth and value of these teams, of these principals, of these drivers. And this is just an effect of that. And I'm wondering when you start to see a point where drivers themselves, because now they're able to leverage themselves in a way that the sport has never seen before, when they start to approach that, when do we have the first F1 driver billionaire?
I think Lewis Hamilton is
for sure
definitely be on his way for that billionaire status some point down the road. He's made some savvy investments. You know, he's involved in an NFL team. We know how those valuations go. And so Toto Wolff, I wrote about this. I actually have a piece that I'm hoping is going out this week about Toto Wolff. But if you look at where he started and you look at, you know, how things began for him, he had modest life. He was born Vienna, Austria. His father had battled brain cancer his entire life until he passed away at when Toto was 10 years old, I believe, or 10 or 15 years old. I don't know exactly the age, but his father battled that for 10 years during Toto's youth, that's painful for a child to be handling. That's got to shape your perspective. It fosters a sense of self-responsibility, right? So with the bad, it shaped Toto into, you know, what we see today. And he made a comment, Toto, in my research about it, Toto admitted that a lot of this is subjective, but he says that watching his father's decline in help, he learned to cope with those who have and those who don't have, and those with opportunity and those without. He learned to appreciate things differently. And then he even tried at 17 years old to get into motorsport. He was very intrigued by motorsport. He competed in German Formula 3. Skills maybe weren't exactly there. He ended up breaking into banking in Poland. He really, really used that experience to refine his expertise as an investor, which I think is crucial. He used that to make investments in Williams. He had started, there was a few companies that he started. One was March 15. He founded that in 1998. March 16 in 2004, they started as technology-related investments. He later moved into more of automotive. And his first breakthrough, I believe, was in 2007. He acquired a 49% stake of the Mercedes DTM race team. Like I said, he had then acquired a 16% stake in Williams. Mercedes actually offered him an equity stake in the F1 team, which he has, I believe, 33%. Yeah. And that at the time was valued at $30 million. Right now, look at the Mercedes team. It's valued over $1 billion, over $1.5 billion. And Toto's stake in that is worth over $500 million, and that's not including his salary. So he's taken a lot of these savvy investments, built them up, and he's gotten to this status that he is. Now, I may foolishly have tweeted out that I strategically tweeted out, this is my exact tweet, Toto Wolff, university dropout, former racer, current team principal, and part owner of the Mercedes F1 team, is now a billionaire. The effect of Drive to Survive on the value of Formula One teams is wild. And of course, everyone took that as me downplaying Toto's actual achievements, when in reality, it was more of saying there was two separate thoughts there. This guy's done a lot with the cards he was dealt, and he also is benefiting tremendously from the rise in the series, the popularity of the series. That's without a question. And you said, you actually made a really great comment here. Gunther Steiner, other principals, other owners, Strolls, they're benefiting. Everybody's benefiting from this. It's not to say that it's only because of Drive to Survive Toto Wolff is a billionaire. But man, it sure helps when the team value doubles, within 4 or 5 years, because the series is now super popular and more sponsors are coming into the sport, more sponsors are coming to the teams. There's bigger dollars flowing in, more consistent large dollars flowing in. Well, yeah, sure. I mean, you've got a market cap. F1's market cap has grown over 263% since 2017. U.S. viewership has increased 123% since 2017. Those are real numbers. Liberty Media acquires F1 for $4.4 billion. Now the thing is estimated to be worth over $16 billion. And if that Saudi offer was legitimate, where they offer 20-some-odd billion, that's an even bigger number that it's potentially worth. So all of this is positively affects everyone involved. Toto just happened to make, not just happened, but Toto smartly made the right moves, the right investments, And now he's reaping that benefit. But you have to credit the Liberty Media marketing blitz, including Drive to Survive, for doing what it's done to increase popularity of the sport, which increases value of the sport.
Yeah. I think the only other billionaire on the grid is Lawrence Stroll, I want to say. Yeah. So yeah. The fact that Toto was able to get a 33% stake in the Mercedes F1 team alongside Ineos and Daimler. And remember that Ineos is the fourth largest chemical manufacturing company in the world. And they are a partner with now a billionaire. I think that that just speaks to the business acumen of Toto Wolff. And I think that shows the kind of leader that he is. The fact that he said when he got in there, he had no problem cleaning bathrooms. This is why he's so militaristic in his approach to the team and wanting everything to be as precise. He says, I'm no better of a team principal if even the janitors aren't doing their jobs correctly. Mm-hmm. And he expects a well-oiled machine. And I think there's a lot that we can learn about leadership from, and in, really in business in general, from Toto. And I think that's why he was, he's been at Harvard Business School, twice now? There's a lot that Harvard Business School students can learn from that, because they explore case studies. That's pretty much the whole premise of business school, is like exploring case studies and figuring out what businesses did right and what they did wrong. And yeah, I think that Toto Wolff's entire resume and Mercedes, really their rise to 8 constructors championships and 7 drivers championships right now under Toto's leadership, that is something that if you're entering the business world is that's somebody you can look up to, truly. And you might not like the way he is portrayed on Drive to Survive. I know that spat with Christian Horner where he said, get a better car. I forget the exact quote.
Where Christian says to him, if you have a problem,
yeah,
change your fucking car. Exactly. Yeah, he tells him to change his car, change your fucking car. And oh, pardon my language, but that's a direct quote. Yeah. Then you know Toto kind of spits back that, like, well, I have printed out that Sergio said it's a bad car or whatever, which was kind of funny. But it's also interesting to see, because now we've heard multiple things like that from Toto, right, where he's like, I've sent you an email, Michael, I've sent you an email, you know, like he's still very old school. Which is, and it's funny to hear, to talk about email being old school, but he still has that old school mentality of like, I've got the receipts, I've printed it out.
Yeah.
I am sending you emails. There's paper trail. He's very, very precise. I think leaves very little room for interpretation on certain things. And I mean, that's a good thing. You've got to respect that. You've got to respect what he's done, what he's doing. And yeah, I mean, it's impressive. I think Toto goes on at some point, if he ever wants to leave motorsport, he could run any of the largest companies in the world.
Yeah.
You know, turn them around. You know, that's if he wants to, right? Does he want to? I don't know. He's put out a pretty great life, and maybe he probably doesn't need the money either. So he's cool. I, you know, Toto's one of those where it's like, all right, I'm not a Mercedes. I'm not a fan of Mercedes, right? The team. I love Mercedes, the brand. I owned one, an AMG. It's a great vehicle. Quality. I love the craftsmanship and the story. And I respect Lewis. I love Lewis Hamilton and what he's doing off the track. Again, he's one of those people I love to hate because he's so successful and he doesn't race for my team. And then you've got Toto Wolff, who you're like, I can't find a reason to dislike you. You're building something and you're doing it better than most. And it's like, there's really no reason for me to dislike you, man. Even if I want to, I can't. And he's become one of those guys that I've liked more and more as I mature and as I grow and I start to have different opinions in my own life, where I'm like, okay, who do I want to model myself after in a business realm? Man, Toto Wolff, it's hard to say. There's a lot of people above Toto Wolff on my list right now of people that I would love to emulate in my own life, right? And I think that's an ultimate display of who he has become. You know, when people, like you said, Harvard, you know, Harvard's got him there teaching classes, leadership classes. That's massive, right? Like, that's an ultimate sign of, I'll say respect, but also an ultimate sign of like, yeah, I've made it. Like, I'm teaching at one of the world's finest universities as a university dropout myself, and I'm able to, and I'm molding the future of leaders in this world.
Well, the thing about that class, or the lectures he's been on are with Anita Elbers. And she is a powerhouse when it comes to melding the world of sports and business. You have so many athletes going through her programs, and it's really amazing. I think that if any of our listeners are curious, look up Anita Elbers on Instagram. Her work speaks for itself. And so the fact that she has someone like Toto Wolff in there, I mean, wow, for any student that got to experience that.
Yeah.
But that speaks to the influence that Toto Wolff right now has in the business world. That, I mean, the fact that one of the best business schools in the world wants him to be a part of what they're building there is pretty incredible. And I wouldn't doubt it if we don't continue to see more of Toto Wolff at Harvard. I would love for him to at some point teach a class at Harvard Business School. There's just a lot that he can teach people in the business world. And like I said, the fact that he is one of those leaders that he's not above anyone. And like I said earlier, his attention to detail matters across the board. And I think that's something that a lot of people overlook. And you can't overlook that because every little detail kind of plays into a bigger picture. So yeah, I think that there's a lot of reasons we can sit there and, you know, fans can sit there and say, I don't like Toto Wolff because of how he's portrayed on a TV show. Sure. But Toto Wolff didn't become a billionaire by making bad moves. So, yeah. You know, you've got to respect the guy. You might not like Mercedes. You might despise Mercedes. Mm-hmm. But you've got to respect what that man has built.
Yeah. No, what he, just the turnaround and what he's doing. And I don't have inside knowledge of the Mercedes operation, but you know, you don't really, up until this past year, it's you haven't heard a lot of discontent or you know, it's almost like New England Patriots of the NFL, where during their success streak, they were very quiet about how things operated, right? It's like, nope, everything stays inside. And they still are for the most part. Like, you still don't hear that thing. And that starts with, you know, their leader, their coach, Bill Belichick. Same thing with Toto Wolff. You know, I think it's very like, hey, we focus on being the best we can. We keep the ship tight. Whether it's the drivers or whether it is somebody who's working as, you know, a press agent or an engineer or whatever, the janitor, like you said, everybody knows their role. Everybody focuses on being the best at what they can be in that team. And that's how teams operate, right? Everyone focuses on what they need to do and how they can be the best at what they're doing. And you have success, right? Which is why it's almost painful to see them not having some success now because of, you know, whatever. And I think they'll figure it out, though. But when you have a leader like that, it instills confidence in everybody. So even when you are, the chips are down, and you're like, oh my God, our car is a tractor. It's like, well, we know we have the best person at the top to figure this out.
Well, Lewis Hamilton has been... or was saying that last year he told the team, we need to fix this, we need to fix that. And apparently they didn't listen to him. So,
yeah. And I thought that was slightly out of character, right? In general, yeah. Not from Lewis, but just in general for Mercedes and Lewis, I guess, where you don't usually hear stuff like that. And yeah. I didn't hear the direct quote from Lewis. I only read, you know, what people were writing. I didn't dig too deep into it because it really wasn't something I was super interested in. Yeah. But you've got to wonder if some of that was, you know, overplayed, overhyped, blown out of proportion. Like, I don't know. Sometimes I don't believe everything unless I've actually heard someone say it directly from their mouths.
Yeah. Well, I also think we can say that Mercedes is having a shit year. Well, they've had a shit last two seasons, let's be real. But they're 67 points off from Red Bull mm-hmm. in the constructors right now. So they're third behind Aston Martin. I mean, who saw Aston Martin ascending the way they have? But I think what now they have, Aston Martin has more points now than they did all of last season.
Yeah.
I think that was.
Yeah, they have. I think they had 55 points all season last season, I believe, and now they've got like 67 in the first three races.
They have 65. So yeah, I mean, nobody saw that coming, but. I mean, I don't, maybe Seb did. Now, I don't even think Seb saw it coming, if we're being honest.
I know.
Seb would have retired if he knew that that was the car that Aston Martin would have right now. But then again, people also say that Seb didn't drive nearly as aggressive as he used to. He kind of fell out of that villain role, whereas Fernando Alonso is still very much the villain. So
he embraces that villain status.
Exactly. So I don't know. I think, you know, kind of wrapping up the Toto Wolff discussion is, yeah, Mercedes has kind of had a crappy last two seasons. Maybe they took that 2021 hangover a little too far. Maybe they got a little too committed to their design concepts. But in any event, they need to listen to the person who they should be taking their cues from, which is Lewis. And make some serious changes. I hope those serious changes come sooner rather than later. But I don't think they're that far back. They're 9 points, I think, behind Aston Martin. So they can still do it. There's still plenty of time for them to get back there and make, you know, make those continued strides. But I don't know. I'm curious to see what Ferrari does down the line. But again, back to Toto's leadership. I think this is the season where it's kind of make or break right now with Mercedes, where if Toto wants to solidify his billion-dollar year with a serious high point, it's how far can Mercedes come back? And I guess that's to be determined. We'll figure that out in November, but, you know.
We'll shift gears a little bit to – we'll get off the Toto Wolff and Mercedes – and we'll switch to Stefano Domenicali here. Stefano has mentioned, and we've heard this a couple times, but they're thinking of expanding the calendar despite what the Concord Agreement says. They've already sent a proposal to have 25, and they, meaning Domenicali and Liberty Media, have sent a proposal to all the teams to have 25 races on the calendar in 2024. Now, this goes into our next topic as well, so I'm just going to throw this out there. Is it ironic that Saudi Arabia has also come out and said they are open to hosting two races? I don't know. We were supposed to have China this year. It was supposed to be this weekend. We're supposed to be the Chinese GP, which would have been 24 races on the calendar. So this would be just adding one more. And if it is another Saudi GP, that'd be 25, right? If we get all what do you think is going on here through their, like, in F1's mind right now with wanting to add more and more races?
It's so strange. I mean, Domenicali has even gone as far as to say that there could be 30 races. So in 2022, Domenicali said, in terms of sporting intensity on the track, in terms of interest from stakeholders, from the public, a new audience coming in and a new way of talking with a new audience and having a clear path and regulations for a future that is very relevant to our DNA and the future technology and sustainability with this type of fuel and hybridization, blah, blah, blah. He said, without any kind of limitation, it is correct to keep that there could easily be over 30 venues that we could easily do a deal with tomorrow, but we cannot go in that direction. So operative words there, clear path and the regulations. One, I mean, again, we've beaten the horse dead many times in saying that F1 and the FIA cannot get on the same page when it comes to regulations. So that's shocking. But the fact that he said we could easily do over 30 venues tomorrow, but we cannot go in this direction. He said this back in 2022. I would maybe say that 25 races would possibly be the max. But that does mean that there are going to be really good tracks that are going to be on the chopping block. So he stressed the need for diversity in the calendar. So you add the South African Grand Prix, you add Vietnam. And it's interesting because right before Australia, Domenicali stopped in Hanoi to meet with top politicians. So we don't really know what these meetings were about, but we can usually put two and two together.
I kind of don't know what to really make of all of this, because there was already a lot of complaints and complaining about the amount of races we have now. You not only have to consider logistics, but you've got to consider, you know, the families of the folks working. These teams are not just the three people you see on Drive to Survive, right? They're hundreds and thousands of individuals that are moving around week to week. And I think part of what happens with the calendar is what people don't see is they're going back to home base in between races, unless you have back-to-back races, right? So it's not just like, okay, we're going to go to Bahrain and then we're going to go to the next race and we're going to go to the next race. It's okay. You're literally back and forth. That back and forth is taxing. It's not sustainable, even though Formula One has been preaching sustainability. And just the logistics to make it happen are wild. I mean, this is not a logistics show, so I'm not going to go into logistics of this, you know, on this episode, but, you know, I've watched and read articles and watched videos and, you know, just even looking at a map, it's mind-boggling, right? I know Haas, their pit wall, they cut it in half from a 6-seat to a 3-seat. And they said that would save them hundreds of thousands of dollars in logistics for the year just by not having to ship the other half of it. So imagine the other stuff that's being shipped all year round. This is one aspect of expanding the calendar. Also, diluting the product. I mean, I'm a firm believer in having a high quality product. This has always been an elevated, a little more elite product than other motorsports. And I'm not saying that the racing is better now. I'm just saying that the product itself has always been delivered to us, the audience, as, hey, we're the pinnacle. Hey, this is elite. This is the best, you know, motorsport series. By adding races, yes, you're making more money, sure, but is the product that much better? And that is where I think F1, Liberty Media, Domenicali, everyone involved needs to step back and say, yeah, if we just add a bunch of races, but all the races suck and suffer because we've decided to add more races that, you know, now drivers are more exhausted, budget caps are causing less upgrades to cars, and, you know, we're not having those technological advances throughout the year because there's less money to go around, less money to spend per race. That is where things suffer. Personally, I would be a big fan of like a 17-18 race season hard stop.
Yeah.
That would be, I think, the perfect amount of races in a season. You spread it out, you pick only the best tracks, the tracks that really allow for racing. If these cars are going to keep getting bigger, or let's just say they've maxed out in size, you've got to have tracks that can handle them and allow the drivers to race. So adding more street style tracks isn't going to help that. It doesn't do any benefits to anybody. It doesn't give anybody benefit to be racing on these tight street circuits where the cars can barely move. And, you know, we see it in Monaco as an example, where it's become a procession and qualifying is the best part of that weekend. But the race is really, it's just follow the leader. There's no passing. I think the latest chart I've seen on least amount of passes, Monaco was right at the bottom, obviously, and it was like single digit passes over the course of the race. I mean, that's not enjoyable. IndyCar, I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago, had something like 1,000 passes in a race. Some stupid number. It was ridiculous. That's exciting. Now, I'm not a diehard follower of IndyCar, so I don't know all the ins and outs of why that happened or, you know, what was going on, but I can only assume it's because the cars are match the circuits, or the circuits that are being raced on somehow match or are set up for the cars that they race. You know, because if those are tight circuits and these are big cars like an F1, that's not going to happen. I mean, there's so many aspects of this to look at. I know that there's a lot of talk that this is a NASCAR tactic, because NASCAR's got like 33 races, 34 races, something like that. And so people are like, oh, look, of course, they're going to Americanize it. They're just going to keep adding more races, like just like NASCAR. It's going to turn into the same thing. I don't know. I think that's when you really confuse the product. You dilute it. You make things confusing for the fans. And if here's the other thing, and I'll stop after this. If the product gets to a point where, as a viewer, I start saying, you know what, that IndyCar is more exciting, or that NASCAR is more exciting, or MotoGP, that's more enticing for me, then you really run into problems. You know, maybe right now, like, you still have the Drive to Survive effect and people are like enamored enough with that and with the heritage and history of F1 to differentiate. But if those things become blurry enough and people see watching F1 or NASCAR or IndyCar or MotoGP or whatever other series, WEC, and they see that as like, it's racing. Racing is racing. Then you're going to run into problems. And that's where I think they need to understand and figure out how to keep the product as high quality as possible.
Yeah, I definitely think that the human component is the real issue here. I mean, Carlos Sainz, for example, posted a really interesting perspective at how he attempts to adjust to jet lag during the Australian Grand Prix. On Instagram, he was posting these stories of kind of his flight adventure, and basically saying at the end of it, I kind of failed my plan. I was exhausted. So, you know, it's our bodies go through so much when we're trying to process jet lag. And if F1 really wants to commit to its sustainability objectives, they've got to figure this out, because like you said about the size of the cars, in F1 30 years ago were conducive to tracks like Monaco. That's not the case anymore. And I understand they have to keep Monaco on the calendar. It's a legacy track. It's just a huge Yep. part of the DNA, and I get it, blah, blah, blah. But the track sucks. It's an uneventful race. Nobody really enjoys it. I think the most exciting aspects about that race are watching celebrities, you know, for example, Tom Brady throwing Daniel Ricciardo a football on a yacht. Like, that is the most memorable thing next to Sergio Perez's crash. But, you know, it's like, those are the things that make that race exciting. It's not particularly, you know, an eventful race. And so they have to do the sideshow to make that race interesting. And that's the shitty part about F1 sort of business model right now. And they've got to figure that out. If they need to figure out how, okay, we need to make the car smaller, mm-hmm. be conducive to these tracks, then those are the regulations they're going to have to sort through, because they can't get any bigger and they're only getting bigger. But it's, you know, again, the human component, these cars are bigger, the athletes have to be stronger, that puts a lot more stress on their bodies. It's a lot of things involved there on top of the travel. Like you said, they're going back to their home bases in between races, and then they're back on the road again. It's just as quickly as they adjust to their time zone, they're back in another time zone. And they've got to figure that out, because at some point you're going to have a very, very high attrition rate in F1. And you need senior leadership in all of these positions, whether it comes down to production, camera crew setting up their equipment, whether you've got the pit crew, whether you've got social media people, even every single detail matters. And you're going to start having a high rate of turnover if you continue to put profits above people. And I hope they know this because, like you said, at what point does the product on track suffer for the whole idea of making more money? And that's not a good look.
And you just and you added a point there that I love, was about, you know, production teams. And I wasn't even considering those folks in my numbers that I was giving or in what I was talking about before. But if you start thinking about that aspect of it, I mean, that's even more, you know, that's probably double. There is likely thousands of production folks that are on site to produce an F1 weekend every weekend. And let's look at the F1 calendar for a second right now. 23 F1. I'm literally typing into my computer as we speak. We have had races. Bahrain started March 5th. We have, and there was testing before that. We go all the way until the Abu Dhabi GP in November. So essentially you have, let's call it December 1st, just to make it a clean, easy break. So there's nothing in December, nothing in January. You already have 10 months of the calendar, of the physical calendar, dominated by F1, save for 1 month in August. And it's not even really a full month. It's like 3 weeks. That's, to me, that's wild.
Yeah.
I don't know of any other sport that runs that long of a calendar, save for maybe MLS, where the calendar covers that long of a stretch throughout the season. I mean, if you add two or three more races, you're either cutting the gaps, making more double and triple headers, or actually you're probably creating quadruple headers at that point, or you've cut out the break completely, at which point you now have 10 months of solid just go, go, go. And I think that's just the wrong way to go about it. Again, if you are the CEO of Formula One, which Stefano Domenicali is, yes, of course you want to add more races. Obviously, that totally makes sense. I just think there's so many damn logistics going into it that you've really got to consider what is best for the actual racing, what is best for the people behind the sport. Yes, you want to worry about, you want to consider your audience. Yes, you want to consider the fans because, you know, we're the ones, but it's not that it's making the sport better. Baseball, for example, Major League Baseball recently changed a lot of rules, which purists don't like, obviously. However, it's turning baseball games that were lasting 4+ hours with unbearable, you know, waiting in between pitches. I'm talking about pitches where it would take 5 to 10 minutes for a pitcher to throw a single pitch. It's eliminating all of that. There's a pitch clock, and there's a bunch of other rules. I have heard from a lot of folks that they're like, wow, it's actually way more bearable to watch. Wow, it's actually interesting to sit there and watch a game or a couple, watch a few innings. People that have not watched the sport in years are now tuning in. They had to eliminate, though, to do that. They didn't add, right? They didn't add more games. There's already 162. They eliminated time spent just sitting around. I'm not suggesting that for Formula One, right? What I'm suggesting is sometimes it's increasing quality through elimination rather than just let's throw on more. And that's where right now F1 is at. And that's where I would love for them to really reconsider adding more races, make better races, have each race be an absolute Super Bowl, right? Blockbuster, monster, World Cup type event, fine, because you'll make tons of money that way, but you also won't dilute the on-track product.
People have to choose between their families or their jobs. And F1 right now is making it really difficult for these people who work there to just be in that position right now.
Yeah. So speaking of more races, our final topic for the day is the new Saudi circuit, the Qiddiya project. Kind of twofold here on this one. We've got the Qiddiya project itself, this massive $8 billion project that Saudi Arabia is developing. They're focusing on getting away from oil money, more in tourism. This project is supposedly 2.5 times bigger than Walt Disney World. It's got entertainment, hospitality, all sorts of things. With that project is a track, a new track they're building. So the current Saudi Arabian track is in Jeddah. And the new, or the Qiddiya project, is outside of Riyadh, which is the capital. I've been to Riyadh, very cool city. It's very cool. The historic center is awesome. I was very impressed when I went. And the hospitality we were treated to was fantastic. That's what I have to say about that. But what do you think about Saudi getting a second race? I guess you have to now consider what Domenicali said about saying we want a 25th race, because it would seem as though we would get two Saudi races because he wants the 24th, 25th race. So what is your take on, let's go with adding the race first, and then we'll talk about the project itself, the Qiddiya project.
Well, first thing, it's not supposed to be completed until 2027. So we've got a few years. But the Jeddah Corniche circuit was supposed to be a semi-permanent track. I'm not sure what the plans are for that thereafter. But I think there's a higher likelihood that you add something like South Africa, which apparently is happening. The government is funding that. I think it was $50 million or something in promoter's fees. And so I think that has a higher likelihood of happening than, say, Saudi Arabia getting two races, unless they paid a significant amount of money at some point.
Which they have.
And we know that Stefano Domenicali, they're not above trying to make a profit. So I'm not sure how much pushback there would be, but I do know that they're expecting about 120 million Saudis and expats to Qiddiya. They're expecting 1 million jobs by 2030. They want to be a top 5 global destination, and they want to increase tourism revenue to 10%. I believe it's 2% now of the GDP. So it's one of those all-in projects. They are fully invested in this. And so under the Saudi Vision campaign, like you said, it's supposed to, it's built around three themes. They want a vibrant society, a thriving economy, and they want to grow their ambitions as a nation. They want to become more desirable. They want to really enhance their visibility in the world. They've been a very closed off nation for many, many decades now, and they want to start opening things up. And like I said in previous episodes, they have gotten rid of compulsory hijab. They are more welcoming of women. They want to hire more women into more roles. And so they're committed to really enhancing, I think, the global initiatives, really. So yeah. It's in theory, Qiddiya seems like a brilliant project. And when you think about all of the different projects going on in the Middle East right now, it's so interesting because there's so many parallels. On one side, you've got countries that are war-torn. And on the other side, you've got countries, Dubai and Saudi Arabia that are just building these monoliths. Mm-hmm. So you know, it does show the economic divide in these countries and, you know, poverty and wealth and all that. And I think from a global perspective, they're going to have to figure out how do we mitigate these concerns, because, you know, people are going to be talking about that more than anything, especially if you're looking to build something that is 2.5 times the size of Disney. So, yeah, again, in theory, I think the project is absolutely brilliant. I think the racetrack, it's been likened to Mario Kart.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not, again, I don't think we're going to ever have a situation where there's two Saudi races on the calendar, because I think that we're going to get to a point in 2027 and past 2027 where you're going to have so many more countries trying to compete for races. So mm-hmm. I think that there's going to be a more competitive fees, perhaps. I think we know Saudi Arabia can afford it, but so can a lot of other countries.
Sure. Yeah. I do disagree. I think we will see it. The politics aside, and I know that's really tough to say, but politics and maybe some of the situations that have happened aside in Saudi Arabia, you've got the Courtney circuit, which the drivers have said good things about. It produces pretty decent races. It's fast. It's beautiful. The entire, like, the circuit, it's gorgeous, right? And then you've got this project that they're spending billions of dollars on to make a global hub for tourism. I'll go even further and say that could be like the Middle Eastern hub for Formula One, right? It would be easy for them to prop up something like what's going on in Vegas, like that big permanent paddock, and be like, hey, this is our permanent F1, whatever, museum thing, whatever that thing may be. So I could very well see it happening. There's a lot of money there. The fact that the Saudis already tried to potentially buy F1 should tell us something. And if Domenicali's list, and I know it's not just Stefano Domenicali that's thinking about it, but he's definitely open to it. The other thing that should be considered is the amount of money it takes for these other countries to actually host a race and get things up to speed. South Africa, Kailami is not ready. It's not FIA grade one. Whether it will be or can be soon, I don't know. They don't seem to have the money there to put this race on. And that would definitely strike a little bit of pause if I'm F1, especially if you are trying to, I mean, again, let's look at what they're doing. You've got a Miami race. You've got a Vegas race, which they've decided to promote themselves. There is a very clear and obvious playbook or formula they're trying to put down here. Miami, you've got this cultural hub in the U.S. A lot of Europeans come there. It's got the nightlife. It's got the beaches. It's got the world-renowned chefs. It's got all that stuff, right? Vegas is kind of the same thing minus the beaches, although there's plenty of other things in Vegas to go and do. I would love to see – I'm the first one to say I would love to see us racing in Hockenheim, Kailami. I would love that. I just posted a video and talked about this the other day. Malaysia, the Malaysian GP, a race in Sepang. It's the director of sports in Malaysia straight up said F1 is just too expensive for us right now to try to host a race here. They are fixing the track up for they're doing a Porsche Carrera Cup the end of this month. So they're getting the track ready for that. It's a great track, but they have no intention on, you know, doing anything for Formula One because of just the sheer cost for the government to put that on. So they're investing like $5 million in fixing up the track, but not for Formula One. There's a lot of great tracks around the world. I don't think that's That's without question. And there's probably a lot of tracks around the world that are way better than tracks that we race on currently in Formula One. But the cities that they're in, the countries they're in, don't have the money to fund or the ability to create the same level of spectacle. And remember, we have to keep that word spectacle in mind, that other races can create. And that right now is what we're up against when talking about, you know, new tracks coming to the calendar. It happened with France. You know, I know they were talking about the French GP and how they could, what could they do to Americanize it? They were like, we'll do anything. We'll Americanize it. So if that's the level that you have to get to just to be able to host a race, it's, you're really knocking out a lot of contenders. And I think that's what we're seeing right now.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be determined by that. I know that David McKillips, the president of International Park Operations of Six Flags, is very confident in the possibility of Saudi Arabia being presented as a, or giving it more secular offerings. And if they're able to, if they're effective in promoting that or presenting that image, they're obviously going to attract more and more people. More tourism is going to go, just flow inevitably. That is an inevitable reality of tourism. I mean, somebody finds out, like Dubai, for example, there was a very unfavorable view of that part of the world for the longest time. And now everybody wants to go to Dubai. And I think that perhaps Saudi Arabia is trying to break into that Dubai level tourism. We'll see if they're successful in that. But I think that a lot is going to be determined on how successful they are, the kingdom is, in terms of getting that tourism going. And if they are, then maybe there's going to be a two race situation on the calendar. But again, there's a lot to be determined there.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what other potential tracks or countries, cities pop up if, you know, while they're talking about this. There was talk about the 30 race calendar, and we don't have to go too deep into this, but there was talk about a 30 race calendar. I don't think we'll ever get to a 30 race. I would hope not. The idea would be to rotate certain races in and out like every other year, right? So yeah, we'll go to France this year, and then we'll give France a break for 2 years, and then we'll host it again, and we'll swap it out with a different track. That could be an interesting way for countries and locations that maybe can't afford to do a race every year, but instead make it a big shebang every 2 or 3 years. I could see, yeah. I could see the pool of tracks expanding to 30 plus race, tracks, but only racing at a certain amount per year. In fact, I would even argue that having a rotating pool of 35 tracks that you race only at about 20 of them, 17 of them per year, would make every single location, amazing. Like, look at Australia, the boom that they got over the last 2 years because they didn't have the race for almost 3 years because of COVID and all that, right? It turned into the biggest event they've ever had 2 years in a row. So there's definitely a benefit to doing something like that. And I would love for them to strategically think about it instead of just slap more and more races on.
Yeah, I agree. I think right now, especially if cities want to host a race, they know they have to step up. They know they have to up their tourism game, their infrastructure game. They know all these things. Even Austin, I mean, God, we've had such a boom here in the last 15 years that the city is almost unrecognizable if you remember what it looked like 15, 16 years ago. And that is because from the US Grand Prix to South by Southwest, there's so many different events that happen here. ACL, for example, that they have to adjust. Austin has to adapt. They need more hotels. They need more restaurants. They need more stuff. And so yeah, it is going to be, I think, a race for these cities to be able to have these offerings to make themselves look more attractive, to have that permanent placement or that rotational placement on the calendar, especially with more and more countries wanting to get involved in it. But like I said, back to Saudi Arabia, it's like, how successful are they going to be in terms of promoting tourism? The same rule applies. And I think for Las Vegas, you're probably going to have a sellout crowd. But how many of those fans are there for the spectacle and how many of those fans are there for the actual racing? Does that even matter anymore? I don't know that it does.
I don't think it matters. I don't think that's what they're thinking about. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, for sure. So it's like, I know racing purists, they want to talk about, what about us? Well, I hate to say it, but I think right now in this era of F1, that they're not thinking about you. They're thinking about the high value clientele that they can possibly bring in. And so they're thinking about tourism dollars, because the more money these races bring to these local economies, the more money these promoters are going to spend, the more money these cities are going to spend to make these events worthwhile, knowing they're going to get it back tenfold. So, you know, a lot is determined by your community's involvement in these races. And like I said, it's time for these communities to step up, knowing that, you know, there's an opportunity to make a significant amount of money on all ends. And it's kind of, it's a shit thing to say, but I think we're past the era where where F1 and the FIA is really concerned about what racing purists are concerned with. And again, I don't like saying that because it seems so ick, but it's the truth, whether people want to hear it or not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I'm full agreement. As hard as it is to admit that, it's like, the racing purists right now are getting maybe the shit end of the stick, so to speak.
Yeah.
Because it is about money. It is about growing and getting, you know, more popular. I mean, a lot of sports are, you know, even the NFL, like the NFL added an extra week, but they took away a week of the preseason. So it's the same amount of football, but you just get one more meaningful game, right? I think it's only a matter of time where you see a lot of this, where it's like, how do we maximize the eyeballs we have? And if that means adding another race, another game, another match, maybe that's what they do. But I personally think there's better ways around that for Formula One, and keeping it that elite level is, I do think that's important. So, yeah, a jam-packed week, jam-packed thoughts. We'd love to hear your thoughts. If you want to weigh in, tweet at us at the VF Castro or at Vincenzo Landino over on Twitter. Be sure to give us a follow. And as always, a rating and review, 5 stars, please, is fantastic for us and helping us grow the show on your favorite podcast player. We talk about things like business, money, politics, government that happens in Formula One and motorsport, mostly Formula One, but sometimes there's other good stories. So join us on the ride every week, every Friday on your podcast player of choice. I'm Vincenzo Landino.
And I am VF Castro.
We will catch you on the next one.
Thank you so much for tuning into the VF1 show. If you liked it, please don't forget to hit the subscribe button. And for previews of next week's show, follow us on Instagram and Twitter at the VF Castro and Vincenzo Landino.